thank you for tuning in to Faith and Reason. This is your host, Dr. John Panero. And for the next hour, we're going to be digging into the Catholic intellectual tradition. Today's guest is Dr. Jeff Paulette from Hope College, located in Holland, Michigan, very near Grand Rapids. Many of you might know Jeff Paulette if you're involved in a local Catholic community. He's part of the Catholic faculty contingent out there at Hope College, a professor of politics. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Morning, John. Thanks for having me here.
Jeff, you and I met at a seminar at Calvin College about two, maybe 3 years ago?
I think it was more
four,
than that.
Four, yeah, it might have been. Yeah. Maybe 2010. That was a seminar on religion and war and society. I was working on missionaries of republicanism at the time. We just happened to sit next to each other. And I think what hit our conversation off is you mentioned Eric Voegelin, and I seem to be the only other person in the room, not well-read or knowledgeable of Voegelin myself, but knowledgeable enough to know that he was important, who seemed to have heard of him. And so I thought it'd be great to have you come in the studio here at Holy Family Radio and talk for a little while about Eric Voegelin. And the best place to start there is just maybe to ask, who was Eric Voegelin?
Eric Voegelin was an Austrian philosopher, historian, sort of a jack of all trades, intellectually speaking. Studied law for a while in Vienna as well. He grew up there and in the 1920s received a fellowship to go study in America for a while. Went back to Austria where, if I'm not mistaken, he taught at the law school at the University of Vienna. And then after the Anschluss occurred, he was forced to flee Austria. That's an interesting story in itself.
And so that's 1938.
38, yep. He was forced to flee Austria and made his way to Harvard and taught at Harvard for a number of years, and then finally made his way down to the Bayou and spent the bulk of his intellectual career at LSU.
So eventually an American citizen, I'm guessing, if
yes.
He's in the country that long.
Yep.
Now, I'm an historian, and I can't resist a good story. So what's the story of his escape from Austria?
Well, there's some interesting angles to this. He had written a book in the 1920s called On the Race Idea. And in this book, he was critical, and this was in part a result of his introduction to American progressivism. He had already seen this in American progressivism, this eugenics, the celebration of the race idea and so forth. And then when he went back to Europe, he saw it especially manifest itself in Germany. So he had written this book on the race idea where he was very critical of the idea of race as an organizing principle for political life. And after the Anschluss happened, he got on the Germans' radar screen, not only for that, but for other critical comments he had made. Already in 1933, so this is not long after Hitler came to power in January of 1933, already by the end of 1933, Voegelin is talking about the new barbarism that is spreading over Europe and is convinced that Hitler is going to be a menace to European politics.
Just because so far what we have from the Nazi Party, besides violence in the streets and, you know, during the voting and all that, is it mostly what Hitler's written or said, right?
Yeah. I mean, part of Voegelin's idea is that ideas make history and ideas have consequences. And when somebody who has articulated ideas gets into political power, you would do well to take those ideas seriously and to analyze them seriously. So it was the nature of the politics that was going on. It was the sort of implicit violence that he saw in the Nazi movement that had him deeply concerned. So, yeah, he was already writing critical stuff about it in the mid-30s. So when the Germans got into Austria, it was clear that he was in trouble. He had to leave in the middle of the night, and it was almost a Sound of Music kind of thing. You know, yeah. He was crossing the Alps by foot.
I knew one of us was going to say that.
Yeah. And left his whole library behind, which he later described as one of the great regrets of his life.
Oh, my goodness.
That he had to leave his whole library behind. Made his way to Switzerland and was caught up at the American embassy. And by this point, he had already had an appointment to Harvard. And nobody at the American Embassy was willing to give him the right of passage into America until he ran into somebody who was a Harvard grad. And once this guy found, oh, you're going to Harvard. Well, yes, then of course. We will let you go to America if you're going to Harvard. There's an interesting story he has in his autobiographical reflections where he talks about how he was at a party. This is not long after he had gotten to Harvard. He was at a party and with his Austrian accent, people are saying to him, well, obviously you had to leave Germany, you must be a Jew. And he said, no, I'm not a Jew. Oh, well, you're a Marxist then. He says, no, I'm not a Marxist either. We don't understand. If you're not a Jew and you're not a Marxist, why did you have to leave Germany? And his reply was, because I don't like killing people for the fun of it.
Wow. That is a good story. And I'm thinking also about his library. I guess, for you kids out there, this is before the Kindle.
Right. Yes.
So you couldn't just carry your library with you in your back pocket. Especially a library like Voegelin had. Well, that was a difficult time for a lot of people. A lot of famous scholars fled Europe and fled Austria. We could keep going down the list of people who fled at that time. I'm thinking of a John Lukács and others who came from
Leo Strauss
from Europe.
Yeah.
But what I'm wondering about Voegelin then is that experience then, which is an actual historical experience. It's an event, right?
Correct.
Did that shape his – how much did that shape his hatred of totalitarianism and totalitarian governments? And I know we'll talk about this as we progress in our conversation, I think. But I wonder how formative that was as opposed to him simply being a philosopher and coming at those critiques had he not had those experiences.
Yes, I mean, you can think of Hannah Arendt, Voegelin, Leo Strauss, John Lukács. Right? I mean, these people who are shaped by the events of Germany in 1930. In the case of many American emigres, people who had to flee totalitarian government. It's the ones that didn't flee that we don't hear about anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it shaped them in two important ways. One is to make them deeply critical of totalitarianism. So in Voegelin's work, there is this constant reflection on what you might call both systematized and rationalized murder, that he thinks this is one of the defining features of the 20th century. So it's bad enough that it's systematized. And in a highly technological society, obviously, you can make that systematic. It's the rationalization of it, the justification of it. And that's what he sees to be the totalitarian temptation. And it results from a bowdlerization or a corruption of political language. I mean, Orwell, the person who makes this sort of argument, right? You first corrupt the language, and then you start doing things that would be otherwise unthinkable.
So would that be like in Rwanda in the early 1990s, the Hutus and the Tutsis and one of those tribes was calling the other vermin, mm-hmm. And all these kinds of all these terms that were just symbolic of cockroaches and pests and things that you would have to kill. And so when the time comes, the marching orders come and the massacre seems to come out of nowhere, but it really doesn't. Is that the kind of thing? Or is it more
than that? It takes place at the level of thought and language first, right? I mean, you have to dehumanize other people. You have to create a concept of social organization and concept of history that makes the elimination of them thinkable. Right. So think about Marx's analysis, for example, of the development of history into the Soviet the socialist utopia. What happens to the bourgeoisie? So you have to have a concept of history itself that allows for the elimination or extermination of such groups. So it's not sufficient to just dehumanize people. Such dehumanization has to be connected to what you perceive to be the goals of human life and of social life in particular. And usually it involves some kind of notion of perfection. Right? If we can just get rid of this group of people, if we can just get rid of the vermin, if we could, you know, I mean, think about, you know, Hitler's thing in Mein Kampf, where he refers to the Jewish people as a cancer, right? And they're sapping the life out of the body politic. And so what has to happen? They have to be excised somehow.
During some of the massacres of the late reformations in the 16th and 17th century, you get that kind of terminology involving infection. And you wonder how can families massacre other families, Catholic and Protestant, going to both ways on this. You've lived in the same neighborhood, let's say, in Paris or elsewhere with these families for centuries. And yet seemingly at the drop of a hat, you're willing to massacre them. How do you get to that point?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, part of it, and I'm sure we'll get back to this, is the hardness of life itself. And the perennial human temptation to blame someone or something else for their problems. Right? I mean, that's as old as humanity itself. What happens and what's sort of peculiar about the modern world in Vogelin's analysis is, again, this becomes systematized into a mode of political thinking and therefore becomes actualized in modes of political action on a scale and a level that really prior to the modern world would not have been.
Because it was not possible, right? I mean, so yeah. The idea of there's this myth that medieval kings were somehow totalitarian rulers, but those of us who know medieval history know that between the nobility on one side and the church on the other and the weather and just reality and disease and all the above, right? With all of that, they're really not as powerful as one might think. The totalitarianism became possible in the modern world, but there are attempts at absolutism, but really on the cusp of the modern world.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes absolutism in the modern world possible is exactly as you suggest, is the emergence of the modern state as an unparalleled locus of power. Right? In the medieval world, you've got a millennium of popes and princes battling one another for political power, and they provide a counterbalance to each other. Right? They check each other in that sense, that you have institutionalized power that's checking the formation and development of other institutionalized power. The nobility does the same
thing.
And
without design, I might add.
Right,
I mean,
this
is all organically developed. Yeah. Nobody sat down as James Madison and the founders did and said, well, let's see how we can balance these things and put them into some kind of good competition and this faction against that faction. That didn't happen. So you're overcoming an awful lot of history then.
You are.
In the modern world.
You are. And what you have in the modern world then is the elimination of the landed nobility as a make weight to the emerging power of the state and the privatization of religion, which also negates it as a make weight to the emerging power of the modern state. So you have the modern state as a colossus. Right, is a sort of unchallenged, unrivaled authority. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can get into what happened in the American founding, but you can say, well, you need ambition to counteract ambition, as Madison talks about in Federalist 51 or something like that. But there's nothing to challenge the power of the modern state. So what you're obliging in the Federalists or something like that is for the state to check itself somehow. And that's just a fool's errand in many ways.
That was the anti-federalist critique of the Constitution, that there's nobody left at the end of the day except the federal government to interpret its own laws.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the other thing about Vogelin in that regard is obviously modern totalitarianism is an enormous problem. But what you also get in Vogelin and Strauss and Arendt and these persons is a very jaded view of political liberalism, of democratic liberalism. And that is because they saw the weakness, the failure of democratic liberalism in the Weimar Republic.
And so by liberalism, what do you mean in this context? We don't want I don't want any of our listeners who aren't quite sure to think we're talking about Jerry Brown.
No. Yes. But by that, I mean modes of constitutional democracy where you have divided authority between legislative branch and executive branch. You have an independent judiciary and you have popular elections.
And based on this assumption of popular sovereignty and kind of an individualism.
Yeah, that ultimately the people have to rule, right? That the locus of authority is within the people. And so you create representative institutions that represent the interests of the people. Again, what these three thinkers, and I can mention others in this regard, all have in common is when they see liberal democracy in this sense, right, this idea of popular sovereignty and representative government, they think about Book 8 of Plato's Republic. And there, Plato argues that you have these five typologies of regimes, types of regimes. And he's got this rather lengthy meditation on democratic man. As a human type that is undisciplined, uncivilized, self-interested, hedonistic, resistant to authority, and understands politics as a sort of indulgence of their interests. And Plato says, of course, these sorts of regimes, because the only authority is located individually, can't sustain themselves. They will collapse under their own weight.
Into probably horrid disorder before the collapse.
That's right? Correct. Mm-hmm. And they become more disordered internally because everybody's appetitive, right? They're just feeding their appetites and ultimately will collapse under the weight of that appetitiveness, of that appetite, and then you'll have chaos, you'll have disorder, which will require a tyrant to come in and impose order upon it. And in Plato's mind, this is the way that political regimes always go. And so for people like Voegelin and Strauss and Arendt and Gadamer and some of these people who are sitting there in Germany in the 1930s, they're watching this unfold, and they're seeing the kind of licentiousness, hedonism and so forth of the Weimar regime, with just a minimum of cultural order in place.
Was the Weimar Republic really that bad?
I think probably not, but that's how they sort of viewed in retrospect. Mm-hmm. But there is, if you look at Germany in the late 20s, it's fairly decadent, right? I mean, if you look at the artistic expressions, at least, right? I guess what we might call cultural decadence. Mm-hmm. And so you get these movements in Germany in the late 20s and early 30s, which are designed to recapture a sort of cultural purity. And that's something that the Nazis can tap into, right, is this kind of purification of culture. Where's all this decadence coming from exactly? It's actually not a bad musical. If you've ever seen the musical Cabaret, that's exactly what this musical is about, right? The decadence of the Weimar regime, this brothel and, these people living these sordid, squalid lives. But at the end of it, what happens, right? The Nazis march in and impose order on it.
So would Voegelin have looked around at the Roaring Twenties fading into the Great Depression in the United States, or similar difficulties in Italy? Is he looking all around in the 1930s?
Yes, he is.
So he's not just simply looking at the decline of the Roman Republic into the Roman Empire, right?
No.
Or medieval states into absolute states. He's got enough contemporary experience to tell him that this makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah, this is cultural decadence, right? When you have and in his mind, and not rightly, this is a really complicated part of Voegelin, but in his mind, liberal democracy tends to yield to a kind of cultural decadence. So think, for example, this is something that Voegelin wrote about, Solzhenitsyn's 1978 Harvard address. Right, where he goes to Harvard University and says, yes, 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 Soviet communism is very bad. People aren't free. It has all kinds of problems. But American liberalism is even worse.
Which is when the booze starts.
Yes, it's when the booze start.
Yeah. Because
there's no internal order. I mean, these are people who have no internal order. So you think about Burke's famous line in the Reflections on the Revolution in France, where he says, it is written in the eternal constitution of things that some sort of check must be placed upon will and appetite. And the less there is within, the more there must be without. People can't order their own lives. You're going to need a government to come along and order it. And for Voegelin, this is the great duality of American politics, of modern politics. Right? It's not that liberalism is disconnected or the opposite of totalitarianism. He sees them as intimately connected to each other.
So the liberalism leads to
totalitarianism.
Yes. So what then is what's the alternative?
Yes.
If you don't like totalitarianism and the human person is free to some extent, then what's the alternative? And in the back of my mind right now, as you were speaking, what I'm thinking about is Pope Gregory's Morari Vos and some of these criticisms, like you find in the Syllabus of Errors and other 19th century papal writings and Catholic writings that are highly critical of religious freedom, calling it religious indifferentism, indifference to the truth, and also, though, freedom of the press. Gregory put it in Morari Vos, I think to paraphrase something like, I just find it hard to believe that 20 or 30 damaging, untrue writings that inculcate licentiousness and sloth, etc., in the people can be outweighed by one bit of truth that's also allowed to be published. He just doesn't see that. And what's shaping him in the 1830s, another French Revolution with nuns and priests killed by the thousands in the church attacked. So there's this long European experience then, it seems, right, after the French Revolution in France and Austria and other places in Central Europe, that their only experience with democracy firsthand is not good.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I keep coming back to this kind of experience versus the abstract in a way. So what does he have? Does he have a solution? Maybe philosophers aren't – philosophers tell us problems, they don't give us solutions?
It's only philosophers who give us solutions.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought that was historians.
No. You know, philosophers like to say that historians are the handmaidens of philosophy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I thought you'd like that. I think Voegelin's answer to that would be there is no solution. And the problems arise when people think that there are solutions. One of the central concepts in Voegelin's thinking is a concept he borrows from Plato called the metaxy, which refers to the in-betweenness of human existence, the tension of human existence, right? We are not gods. We are not beasts. We are not eternal, but neither are we completely bound by time, right? I mean, so all these, you know, we're not imperfect, but we're not perfect either. So this tension of existence, which is in Plato's analysis and in Voegelin's analysis, and this is really one of the key concepts for Voegelin, it's irresolvable. But the perennial human temptation, again, is to leap out of it. You know, an example I always like to use when I'm talking about this in class is from Act 1, Scene 7 of Macbeth, where Macbeth is contemplating killing Duncan. And, you know, great Shakespearean language, but here upon the shoals and banks of time, you know, we are limited. And how do I get to the other side? And toward the end of this speech, Macbeth says, but vaulting ambition overleaps itself. And for Voegelin, this is always the ideological temptation, this overleaping, this leaping out of the human condition. And he sees liberalism, as I've discussed it here, is a kind of overleaping also, right? If we just get the right institutions in place, and if we allow people to vote, and if we have these concepts of popular sovereignty and so forth, we'll come up with a just, well-ordered society.
So he's, as a critic of that temptation, he's also then a critic of modern ideology, and this is what attracts and very traditionalist-minded conservatives to Voegelin, who
yes.
never called himself a conservative. In fact, I think he may have said, "No, I'm not."
Yes.
But kind of person you can't really nail down. But you could see the attraction there then, but also the revulsion then by progressivists
mm-hmm.
and ideologues who think they do have the right recipe for human happiness.
Yes.
So all this gets at the question here then of. What then of the transcendent, the divine, God? Is there any way to put these pieces together? Because this sounds like the kind of – this is the human problem that the Christian fathers and others, biblical authors, would have written about as well,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a problem. We have this problem. It's selfishness or it's this – we think we can build a tower to heaven, but it usually doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Pick your biblical parallel. And Voegelin, he came from Austria, very, very Catholic country. So I wonder if there's any connection then to faith and the Catholic faith in particular.
Well, that's a really complicated question in Fogel's
case.
Those
are the best
kind. Yeah, those are the best kind.
Come on, you're a philosopher. Clarify it for us. You have 1 minute.
1 minute. Yeah. Excellent. Fogelin is in a long-standing tradition which sees this complementariness between Greek philosophy and Christianity. Right? So, the old idea that that Greek philosophy is the Old Testament for the Greeks, mm-hmm. And so it is in his mind a kind of mode of revelation.
Which Pope Benedict was very fond, extremely fond of Greek philosophy.
Yes,
as this is the way it was meant to be.
Yes,
help prepare the way and for humanity to think about the things that the incarnation would bring.
Yeah. The preparation for the gospel. Yeah, and this is a longstanding controversy in Christianity. There are some people who resist this idea that Greek philosophy is that accommodatable to Christianity. There are others who kind of embrace the idea. Fogelin is certainly in the latter camp. He will use the terms epiphany or theophany. These moments where God is made known somehow. So there is clearly a sense for Fogelin in which God is made known to human beings. What's less clear in Fogelin is any sort of distinction between these kinds of modes of human consciousness and divine revelation. I mean, these seem to be kind of equal to him. So if you ask him, what exactly is revelation? Revelation is an articulation of the nature of God. This is typically done by human reason. So he doesn't really distinguish between reason and revelation. In his mind, these are not just comparable things, but more or less identical things. It's Protestant liberalism. And that really is his background, is Protestant liberalism.
Okay.
There are parts of it that he rejects. But he's never a Catholic communicant. He's never baptized in the Catholic Church. He's not a churchgoer. He has a phrase at one point where he's asked about people who are into Fogelin, they do a lot of writing on Fogelin and Christianity. What is the relationship here exactly? And Fogelin's own comments about Christianity at a personal level are very cryptic and hard to decipher. But one of the things he says is that a thinker has an obligation to dwell within and to accept the most differentiated mode of consciousness available to him at the time. Because consciousness emerges, develops, differentiates historically. And so it's always going to be, right? I mean, Socrates is an improvement over Hesiod, and Hesiod is an improvement over Thales. These are differentiations. These are gains in human cognition,
so there is a sort of progress.
Oh, absolutely,
moral and philosophical, intellectual progress. Then
yes, yeah, this is an interesting issue in Fogelin. When he gets to Harvard, he begins a project known as the History of Ideas, and he gets 7 volumes into this.
Wow.
Right, so having just written a book, I'm sure you'll appreciate it. I'm not talking thin volumes either.
No, I'll be. I would have to live to be 132
yes,
to produce.
That's quick math.
Yeah,
he writes 7 volumes of the History of Ideas until he gets to the German idealists at the beginning of the 19th century, and he's writing the chapter on Schelling in this. And he has this epiphany that ideas don't have histories. So he abandons the project. He never publishes it in his lifetime. It's been published posthumously, but it was never published in his lifetime. He abandons the project because of what he realizes is ideas don't have history. What happens in history is concrete human beings have experiences, and they symbolize these experiences through language and through myths and so forth. These symbolizations are ways of communicating the experiences, but the task of the thinker is always to get back to the experience itself and to ask, what is it that this person is experiencing and how are they articulating this? And they can articulate this with more or less clarity. So Plato for Voegelin is one of the great articulations, right? This is a moment where this articulation of the essence of reality, of the nature of reality, gets articulated with great clarity. And then what you have in Aristotle is a way of kind of systematizing the Platonic insight, the Platonic epiphany. But once that's been done, you can't believe in intracosmic gods anymore after Plato. Right? That just becomes an impossibility, Voegelin says. So this becomes a real advancement, progress in human thinking and human cognition. Now, the thing about human beings, of course, is that they can go backwards also. So this is part of the revelation for Voegelin, is that ideas don't have histories, human beings have histories, and that while symbolizations can be more or less true, they don't evolve historically in a straight line. I mean, he's not a Whig. Right? Mm-hmm. This isn't a Whiggish conception of history in that sense. You know, this is one of his discoveries. Actually, it's based upon reading Carl Jaspers, that things just don't go in straight lines. You know, that the meaning of things kind of transgress the axis of time. They're not linear in that sense. So people, thinkers might go forward, but they might go back also.
So you mentioned the Whig historians, which makes me think of Whigs like Edmund Burke, for example. So Voegelin then probably wouldn't have been too big of a fan of somebody like Burke, who would look at the organic growth of tradition and say, tradition is such a something we ought to put a lot of stock in as the trial and error of past centuries, you know, that's produced this, because we need to, what do we need to do? Make sure we know the source of these traditions and that they make it meaningful for us in some way. I mean, if we've systematized it, let's say into, magisterial dogma.
Right.
Is that going to be a problem then if we've turned these into, you know, like turning these ideas into an ideology? Is that the way he would look at dogma or a tradition that we see as binding and sensible, but we weren't there at the experience that produced the tradition then. But it seems to have worked out well over the centuries.
Right. I think he would see this as, an inherent problem. Voegelin is not a Democrat in that sense. He's an elitist. Great thinkers, great minds articulate great truths. They have to be communicated somehow to people who are not great thinkers and great minds. I mean, the bottom line is most of us aren't philosophers, and there are all sorts of reasons why most of us aren't philosophers. It might be limits of our cognitive abilities, but mainly it's because we don't have time.
I've always thought that about, you know, the Athenians, when you're in 60% of your population is enslaved and doing the work for you, you have time to sit around and eat grapes and philosophize and think about stuff.
Philosophy is a leisure activity, and it requires great leisure, and it's only possible for people who are having the material conditions of their existence taken care of by somebody else.
Like a Hope College professor.
Well, like a Orton Aquinas professor, for that matter. Okay. No, but that is true, right? I mean, the professorate is a sort of residual of that, right? I mean, I'm not scrambling for my daily bread, and you know, the material conditions of my existence are taken care of in some sense.
Yeah, and a rightly ordered professoria, this is what they would concern themselves with, right?
If so, yes.
Not junkets and ideologies.
Yeah, I mean, there isn't culture. This is Joseph Pieper, who's a great Catholic thinker. This is his argument, his book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture, right? That unless you have a leisured class, you can't have culture in the way that we understand it.
And Tocqueville said that about America at a time. And he had some of these same critiques about democracy.
Yes.
That is, it's, you know, it's got its problems, but, you know, monarchy has its problems too.
Correct.
Aristocracy has its problems.
It's right. We don't live in a perfect world.
Yeah.
That's got to be the start. And we're not going to make it perfect through human action. For Voegelin, that's the key, is the ideological temptation is the idea that you can make it perfect through human action.
So to the question, why should Catholics read Voegelin, then, that's a very Catholic answer. Mm-hmm. Isn't it? About reality and about the world in which we live.
Yeah, and to go back to your question about the magisterium, you know, for Voegelin, now the question is, how do we, once these insights are gained into the nature of truth and into the nature of reality, how do we protect them? How do we preserve them? So this is the dilemma you might say, that social organizations have. They have to protect these insights, and so they dogmatize them, they doctrinalize them, they systematize them. When Vogelin looks back at Plato and Aristotle, he regards Aristotle as a kind of flattening out of the Platonic epiphany and so forth. And that all doctrine is a kind of flattening out, but it's a necessary flattening out because, A, most human beings can't come to the truth on their own. B, these truths are typically generated under systems under times of crisis. Right. I mean, philosophy always operates in crisis mode.
Including Vogelin's own life.
Including Vogelin's own life. And, no, and again, right, this is for him, you know, when he is a young professor, they look back at the Platonic dialogues and the disorder of Athenian society, at the beginning of the 4th century BC, and they say, holy cow, that's the same thing. The problem is when you systematize in this fashion, what tends to happen is that the ideas are no longer referred back to the generating insights, to the generating experiences. And so the task of thinking, if you're in a church, is to be constantly on the watch of this sort of calcification of doctrine, that it becomes static. So I think he'd be Burkean in that sense, right? He doesn't want it to become static. It's never a finished product. But whatever truths there are have to be referred back to the experiences that generated those truths.
Which is – I think that's the, you know, the best description of any kind of so-called spirit to Vatican II would be exactly that. That is, let's make sure that we don't just know about Jesus. We don't just know the intellectual tradition, but we actually know Christ, right?
Yeah.
And have the personal encounter, in other words. There's been such a great emphasis on that type of language the past 50 years or so. And I think that's a Vogelinian type of insight then.
That yes.
It's not just enough to be what the Eastern Christian writer Fidel calls a rubricist, or what we would probably call a fundamentalist. Whether a Protestant or Catholic, I think we're all we're all very given to that, you know. If
yes.
I just follow the recipe today, and that's gonna make me happy.
Right.
And the insights don't go deeper, and there's no real experience there. But I could take a kind of a comfort in the list of rules, the way an ideologue maybe takes comfort in his ideology.
Yes. Yeah. So you can get fundamentalism on the religious side, you get ideology on the secular side, but they're the same thing, and that is. How do we deal with the difficulty and uncertainty of life? Vogelin has a great line in one of his books where he says, human beings would always prefer certain untruth to uncertain truth. Mm-hmm. And the hardness of Christianity, according to Vogelin, is that it puts uncertainty, and this is sort of age of anxiety Christianity in some ways, but it puts uncertainty at the core of it. I mean, Paul in the book of Hebrews. I mean, the fact that we've had an incarnate God who is now ascended, the fact that we have been promised life in Christ's kingdom, but it's not here, or at least not yet, or not fully, right? I mean, however Christians talk about these things, they live life in tension and in uncertainty.
And seek salvation in fear and trembling.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So for Vogelin, this becomes really the great human problem is how to bear the weight of uncertainty. And how to bear the weight of a truth that is incomplete and unknowable. And I mean, this is how we talk about God, right? God is love. God is the center of our existence. God is the source and origin of our existence. He's also the end of our existence. But God's also unknowable, right? God is also inscrutable. So how do you live with such a God? How do you worship such a God?
Yeah. So we can know things about him, but we can't fully know him until
yes.
we're face to face.
Yeah, Aquinas talks about this when he talks about God, that there is – Calvin talks about this. This is my old Calvinist heritage coming out here. God ad intra and God ad extra. There's God as he is for us, and there's God as he is in himself. Aquinas talks about the tetragrammaton, the four letters representing God in the Hebrew Old Testament. But right, these hidden mysteries, right, these hidden depths of God that are just unknowable to human beings, that are inscrutable.
And the idea that's the perfectionist, right, mm-hmm. the progressivist then is not going to like things being unknowable, but we all don't. So we're,
right.
I hadn't thought of it this way before, but I often tell my students at Aquinas College that, one of the things that I'd like them to leave the class with, besides knowledge of actual historical events and being able to put them in order, is this ability to manage complexity. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you're describing. We have a new Catholic Studies class at Aquinas that was created by Dr. Michael McDaniel in the math department, and it's about unknowability. It's theorems and proofs about the limits of human knowledge, but done in mathematical language mm-hmm. that just communicate to us that there are things we can't know, particularly in an infinite universe.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's a very humbling thing, and it's striking then that rather than generating humility, there's that part of our nature that goes in the opposite direction. I want to overcome nature, not grace perfecting nature, but
right.
I'm going to perfect nature.
Yeah, on the Oracle of Delphi, one of the phrases on there is know thyself. And part of what that means is know that you are a man and not a god. Mm-hmm. When Fogelin looks at the mass movements, the ideological movements of the 20th century, and this is an idea he gets from Camus in many ways, he says the problem is they are no longer willing to be merely human beings. They want to be gods. And again, this is the old human temptation going back to the garden. Ye shall be as God. And Fogelin calls this the Promethean urge in modern thinking. And it comes from the old Greek play Prometheus, where Prometheus has this secret that he knows how the line of the Olympian deities is ultimately going to end, and they've punished him by having the eagle come down and pluck out his liver every day, and he'll be released from his bondage if he'll yield up the secret, and he refuses to do so. In the famous line, "In a word, I hate all the gods." And Fogelin says that's what the modern world is ultimately all about. This Promethean urge, I hate all the gods. And why do we hate the gods? Because there are limits on our freedom. There are limits on our humanness. We want to be gods ourselves. And if you look at the great ideological thinkers of the modern world, for example, Marx in his work on Hegel, he says this is and always has been the creed of philosophy. I hate all the gods. Whereas Nietzsche says in Zarathustra, if there were gods, how could I stand not being one? Or in the parable of the madman, where he says, where he talks about the death of God, and he says, must we not become gods ourselves simply to appear worthy of the deed? So all these the mass movements, the totalitarian movements, Fogelin says the originating experience, it's not about the dogma. Right? It's not about the details of Marxist thinking and Das Kapital or something like that. It goes back to this initial experience, and that is that they've been thrown into a world that is imperfect, and they're hostile to that world. They hate that world, that imperfect world. And what they want to do is bring salvation to that world. And they're going to do that themselves. And they're going to create now a utopia. They're going to create a perfect society. If we can just eliminate sin, because sin is not within. Sin is something external in the world. It can be other groups.
Yeah, as we talked about earlier. There's certain people who are the problem. Certain politicians, political parties, other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not ideas, but we're talking about people here. This quest for certitude then. I think one thing we should talk about, we have just about 12, 13 minutes left on the program. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. This is Dr. John Panero. I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Paulette of Hope College about Eric Fogelin and looking at Fogelin, this 20th century philosopher, for insights that can really help us, as we've been saying, I guess, know our limits. This makes me think about a couple things. One is this quest for certitude and how Voegelin connects that to Gnosticism. I think that would be worth talking about. Mm-hmm. But the second is Voegelin was such a critic of liberalism, and I think I can see why now. The more we talk, what are the limits on human freedom going to be, given our selfishness and penchant for abusing freedom and turning it liberty into license, etc. And we could tackle all that in 12 minutes.
In 12 Jeff. Minutes, excellent. Yes. Well, the first question, you mentioned Gnosticism, which is obviously ancient.
And many of our listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with Gnosticism as a general term for early Christian heresies that were combated by St. Augustine and others.
Yes. And the idea of there's sort of two realities, right? There's the perfect reality, good, God, light, and there's the imperfect reality, evil, Satan, darkness, and all this sort of stuff. And that the spiritual discipline is to emerge out of the darkness and into the light.
Usually with a secret knowledge of some kind.
That's correct, where the term comes from, the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. And one of the things Voegelin did with I have in my office his collected works, which I think is 34 volumes or something like that. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
What he accomplished in his lifetime. But one of the things, and he wrote on virtually everything. I mean, it's amazing the scope of what he wrote on. But one of the things he did is he just found out whoever the expert was in a given field at that time, and he contacted those experts. And so in his great work Order and History, the first volume is on Israel and Revelation. So what does he do? He contacts Gerhard von Rad and all these great Old Testament scholars and says, "All right, I need to know all about this," and then he kind of puts it together using his own framework of analysis.
That's great. He doesn't think he's an expert in all these things.
No, he does not.
That's a sign of humility. Mental acuity and humility, for sure.
He's deferential. Who are the people who really know what's going on here? And one of the things he's looked at are in the early part of the 20th century, there are thinkers such as Kurt Rudolph and Hans Jonas, who are again looking at what's going on in Europe in the early part of the 20th century. But they are scholars of antiquity. And in his great work, The Gnostic Religion, Jonas, who is a Catholic thinker, the epilogue is really a terrific piece. I'd recommend it to anyone, where he says, I'm studying all these ancient cults, Gnostic cults, and they're oddly familiar to me. And I realize that a lot of the same thing is going on in modernity. And so he starts drawing all these connections. And then Voegelin picks that up.
And what's the name of the work you said?
The Gnostic Religion by Hans Jonas, J-O-N-A-S. Great work.
Thanks.
And Voegelin picks up on this theme. And he says, that's what's going on in modern thinking. That's right. If you look at Hegel and Marx and Heidegger and all these great modern thinkers, they are sort of repeating these Gnostic heresies, which is that the world is badly organized. We are thrown into it against our will, however you want to talk about human contingency that way. There is a kind of principle of salvation from this world, and that this salvation is a mode of knowing for a particular group of people who have privileged knowing. It's a privileged form of knowing.
The vanguard of the vanguard, as Lenin called them.
That's correct, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so you have this intellectual elite who are the privileged knowers. And now we'll remake the world and affect human salvation through human action, through a political program. They will remake the world and introduce the perfect society. So Voegelin, for this right, that the modern world is a kind of Gnosticism, right? It's salvation through knowing. But what's unique about modern Gnosticism is this introduction of revolutionary action. We're not going to wait for God to bring salvation. We are going to effect it through revolutionary political action.
Well, and the ability, Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago talks about the difference. Is he talking about Macbeth or Hamlet? He says, the difference between death then and now is the body count. It's ideology.
Right.
In other words, but also technology. I don't think it's just ideology that makes the body count higher. I mean, the Cambodians can wipe out a third of their own people.
Yes.
The Khmer Rouge, for example. That's that's a very dangerous thing about the modern world. So when we try to remake the world, apparently, mm-hmm. not only does it end badly, it doesn't end badly on a small scale, typically. I mean, it's an epic
right.
failure.
Now, what you get in thinkers such as Voegelin and George Grant, and I think Heidegger also, is the idea, though, that technology is not an ancillary to that, right? That technology is itself a kind of mode of this sort of Gnosticism.
Would you agree with that? Is that compelling to you? I always wondered to what degree. It's a good question. Is technology neutral? People debate this about television, that the device itself is not neutral, that it trains you to have less of an attention span. It doesn't even matter if it's educational programming that you're watching. It's still problematic in and of itself.
Yeah, that's my view. I don't buy that technologies are neutral, but human beings are tool makers. So if you think about technology in a very limited sense, just as a tool and needing to make tools, then that analysis wouldn't hold. But if you think about technology, the term itself, right, this combination of knowing and making, and that making is not only a, but it's the mode of knowing. This is where the analysis is in Heidegger and Grant and Voegelin and these people, is that modern technology is something different. It's an epoch. It's a way of thinking about the world, that this is what we are as human beings. And in that sense, the difference would be, Aristotle would say, just because you can do something, it doesn't mean you go ahead and do it, right? There are limits, there are prohibitions on modes of knowing. Or the Catholic Church, right? The prohibitions on cadaverism. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was always a teaching of the Catholic Church. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you do it, right? There are limits on knowing. The technological era is an era where there are no limits on knowing. If you can do it, you do it.
George Weigel said something very profound when he spoke as part of the Catholic Studies speaker series a couple years ago at Aquinas. And he said a good Catholic education, a good Christian education, is going to ensure that you don't just ask, can we do this, mm-hmm. but should we do this? Mm-hmm. Ought we do this thing? That's always the right question to ask. But too often the modern world has us asking, can we do this? And if we can, we're going to try it. And I think that's probably a truism. If I don't try it, somebody somewhere is going to try it.
And that's why, whatever language we want to use, the iron cage, the technological epoch, Heidegger's view, right? I mean, there's no way out of that in a certain sense. This is the way we approach things. If we can know it, we're going to know it. If we can do it, we're going to do it. And that's because we don't locate human knowing and human making within a larger vision of reality, within a larger understanding of the world and truth. For us, the world and truth is human knowing and making, right? That is the truth. That is the reality. And that's why this kind of confluence of ideology and technology that has led to destruction on hitherto unimaginable scales is the reality of our lives today.
So I recall during the early Iraq War in 2003 and 2004, Bush administration officials talking about making their own reality or creating their own reality in Iraq. And I recall President Barack Obama, maybe in his inaugural address, talking about remaking the country, right?
Yeah.
And so you see this language all across the political spectrum in America. And I guess from what we've been hearing you say about Eric Voegelin over the past 50 minutes or so, that's because they're heirs to a common political liberalism.
Right? Yes.
That's kind of the American way. So what – in the last 4 minutes, we'll try to do something that Voegelin's critics said he never quite did, make this practical.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple practical things. One would just be, is Voegelin like the musician's musician? That is, musicians listen to musicians' musicians, right?
Right,
but
yeah.
The rest of us don't. Is this a philosopher's philosopher? Is there somebody we can read? And I would include myself among average listeners when it comes to Eric Voegelin. Is there somebody who synthesized Voegelin or summarized Voegelin? Or is he readable enough himself for people who are educated and interested in truth and these sorts of problems?
Yeah, no one has ever accused him of readability.
I thought not. That's right. What hence the question.
Yeah. No, there are, but I mean, I would recommend him. And as a starting point, his little book, Science, Politics, and Gnosticism, it's a great place to start if you want to read Voegelin. I mean, he does talk about politics. Michael Federici, who teaches at Mercyhurst University and wrote a nice introductory book to Voegelin, was telling me the story just yesterday, in fact, of how Voegelin, when he had a heart attack, this is when he was in his late 70s or something, he was being wheeled into the operating room. And as he's being wheeled into the room, he turns to his wife and says, "Sell U.S. steel." Which is, I mean, the guy was engaged in the world, right? I mean, he was practically minded. You know, the rule of law. Mm-hmm. You know, understanding, as Madison said, that men are not angels.
Yeah.
That you have to try to figure out how to make an imperfect government out of imperfect human beings.
That was Madison also said, in other words, if these problems are sown in the nature of man,
that's correct.
As he says in Federalist Number 10,
yes.
then what do we do?
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, we have just a couple minutes left. This is Dr. John Pinero. You're listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, Battle Creek. We've been talking about Erich Voegelin. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to mention Front Porch Republic, an online magazine, website. I'm not sure what all you would call it that you're associated with and that you're one of the primary editors of, because the tagline has to do with limits and liberty, and it sounds like a very Voegelinian thing, that is, understanding that there are limits. And maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about that and anything else you think we ought to know in the closing minutes here.
Oh, I appreciate that. FPR, Front Porch Republic, FPR as we call it, is an online journal. And there are certain thinkers who I suppose are kind of influential in the way we think about things. Voegelin is one. Alistair MacIntyre is one. Wendell Berry is one. We started as a response to the economic crises of 2007-2008, that something had just gotten out of whack here, right? That this wasn't just a kind of hiccup, but revealed some deep systematic problems about the unwillingness and inability of Americans both to live within limits, but also understanding that we are embodied creatures who live in places and are called to tend to and care for these places. I mean, part of what happened in 2008 was absentee ownership, and this kind of unreal economy, what, you know, Aristotle in Book 1 of the Politics talks about natural wealth and artificial wealth. This is all artificial wealth. It's not related to actual human needs and human productivities. So this was sort of a way of kind of calling us back to a way of thinking about human liberty in a very embodied kind of way. As we live in our communities, how do we live in, sustain, and create humanly sustainable, humanly meaningful communal lives? Because on the national scale, it's gotten completely out of whack. I don't think you can have a political community of 317 million people. I think it just doesn't work.
Yeah, community, I think by definition in the Greek implies a kind of a small area hemmed in by very natural borders and other commonalities.
Yeah, I know Aristotle in the Politics, one of the first questions he asks, what's the appropriate size of a polis? In Plato's Laws, one of the questions he asks. We don't ask that question anymore. But that's part of the crisis. So FPR is an attempt to really do that. We have a conference coming up in Louisville in September. You can go to our website and see more information about that conference. But I think it's an important kind of reaction to the questions you're asking.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jeff Paulette, for being on Faith and Reason today. It's been a real pleasure. Very insightful.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
And thank you for listening to Faith and Reason here on Holy Family Radio. This is Dr. John Pinero saying good afternoon.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.